What's up, heretics? Welcome to the Religion of Speed podcast, the podcast for car nerds by car nerds. I am Matt Overstreet.
And I am Chris Huffman.
And today on the show, we actually have a guest. We're back to having guests again. We have the mic set up. So welcome to the show, Evan Mustapick.
Hey, everybody. How are you? Just checking in.
I got the name right, right?
Yeah, you did. You nailed it.
Nice.
Absolutely.
Thank God.
Like three words smashed together.
I struggle with those Croatian-backed names. Petinkovic got me, you know, that took me a long time for Hamza on the show here.
To be fair, Hamza didn't even want to say his name either.
This is true. He's like, also when you mispronounce his name, he's just like, yeah, whatever.
That's where you get to most times, honestly. So anytime somebody comes up and asks me, I'm like, just hooked on phonics, dude. Like, just pronounce it out. You'll be fine.
See, that's the great part, because like when I was a kid, I would always pronounce words how they were spelled.
Yep.
Like it took me forever to like get the nuance of English and all the weird, like, oh no, that's a silent letter. I'm like, then why is it there? I'm gonna say it. So yeah, no, that's perfect for me. I can actually say your name. But yeah, Evan, thanks for coming on the show. We've been a long time since I've seen you before.
It's been about a year. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. We originally met at Track Attack, just like I think I've met pretty much all of my friends, except you know, Huffman, I worked with you. Aaron, yeah. I work with you. So it's either work or Track Attack. That seems to be the places.
You don't spend a lot of time in the bars.
No, not really. I'm not really a bar person. We found that out the other night.
That's true.
Yeah. I don't think you have time for it when you do this.
Right,
you
know, exactly. We are just now recording the podcast because we were busy trying to get Aaron's CRX running and scrambling on that a little bit, but unfortunately did not get that fired.
Well, one reason to swap for the B, right?
Right, exactly. So,
or K. Or just advocate K.
Or a J series.
Or a J. nice hole in the hood for the valve cover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. I still want to... Why did your car just beep, Huffman?
Because I hit my pocket.
the issues of having cars in the garage while we're podcasting. Normally, it's phones. Normally,
that's
it's phones
true.
Going off.
Which that reminds me. I'm going to make sure I'm on silent here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, your phone's not getting service, so...
Yeah, I actually just got a bar.
Oh, nice.
As,
so
yeah,
that's where
you started.
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to get you on the podcast, Evan, because you've had a pretty long history with cars and everything, and well, I was hoping you have your Integra up here today, but first thing I want to ask is, when did you first know cars were going to play an important part of your life?
You know, so it started at a really young age for me. Every Thanksgiving, we would go to my Uncle Jerry's house, and he had this 1934 Ford that he had swapped a big block Chevy motor into, and it was this old classic with a rumble seat, and he would start it up for us every year on Thanksgiving. He would never move it.
Yeah.
It just sat in the garage.
Did it move at all, or?
He would take it out and do the occasional burnout, but never in front of us.
Okay.
Jerry had a wild soul, but he was super, super reserved in person. You never really got to see that side. But my older cousin David would always bring his 240s and his RX-7s to Thanksgiving and show Jerry.
And where are you from?
Originally Vero Beach, Florida.
Okay. So yeah, cause like the idea just, it's weird for me cause I grew up in Michigan.
Right.
So any family member showing up with any import was just like, that didn't happen. We didn't, I didn't know what a 240 SX was. So I was in college, I think.
Yeah.
But
yeah, for me, it like, there were a series of moments throughout my childhood that really pulled me into this whole thing. Seeing Jerry's Ford, seeing, you know, my cousin's 240, and then later on, he had come back from Afghanistan with an RX-7 that he had, you know, built up to 500 horsepower, really nice set of RPF-1s on it, sticky track tire, and took me out for a ride, and we hit this corner doing about 80, and it just felt like the car had claws in the road, and it just gripped. And it was an amazing feeling for me, and I remember being hooked on that. But backtrack a few years, I was about 8 years old. My dad picked me up from school in this BMW Z3M.
That's Huffman's thing.
I'm a huge Z3 fan. It's a one-way relationship. They do not love you back.
Yeah, no. Most BMWs do not. Yeah. So he had picked me up, and we get within about a mile of the house, and it's a really secluded road that nobody ever really drives on. And my dad's a really, really big guy, 6'5", 280 pounds, picks me up out of the passenger seat, sets me on his lap, and he works the pedals while I get to drive the car the rest of the way home.
Wow.
And I was, you know, as an 8-year-old, you're absolutely hooked into that from the moment. Like, and he had just always impressed upon me that, you know, real drivers learn how to drive the corners. You know, he was never a horsepower junkie. He was always about imports, you know.
Which is kind of surprising coming from Florida, because there's not a whole lot of corners down there.
Right.
It's a pretty flat state.
Right. So my dad actually grew up in Northport, Long Island, New York.
Okay.
So growing up driving mountain roads, he had a friend that had a, you know, Jaguar XKE and stuff like that. And they would go out together all the time. And my dad was into MGBs and all other sorts of roadsters. So, which is how you end up with me being a 6'4" guy driving a Miata.
Yeah, it was destined.
Right. You know, it just runs in the family.
Have you had to do the foamectomy on yours?
No, I actually just do Kirky aluminums mounted straight to the floor.
Oh, nice.
So that's the solution for it. It's definitely spine jarring, but it works.
Well, and you're going to be dropping the floor on that car too, just to get a little extra room, which I didn't even know that was a thing in Miatas, but
I had to dig for it too. You know, I'd previously had a 99 NB and I really didn't have that much of an issue with it, but I'd only tracked that car once before I ended up unloading it. I'd had my sights set on my buddy's Mark 7 GTI. I'd driven it once and he borrowed the Miata and we were just like, all right, this is kind of the way.
Yeah.
So I ended up doing a deployment. I came back from that deployment, bought myself a Mark 7 GTI and was absolutely in love with it.
Now, the Mark 7, is that the one you were telling me that you rebuilt the transmission on the dining room table?
Yes. Yes. I had done a hard launch and I was kind of like on a little bit of a dip in the road and I had gotten some slack back in the axle. Mm. I'd initially preloaded and everything, went for the hard launch and it sheared the axle off inside of the differential.
Oh no.
So I'm like limping it home with one axle, just getting that wheel going. I'm like revving it out. I'm like, but it was silent. It didn't make like that axle buckle noise where you got like that loud thump on the way.
Yeah.
So it was such a smooth shear that I had dropped the transmission and, you know, the axle end came out because those are cup designed. So you have a cup and a mating half. And there's a bolt that runs through that. So as I put the transmission back up into the car, I'm like, you know, I'm not seeing, the clutch didn't give way. There was no issues there or anything like that. The axle cup just slides out and hits the floor.
And I was like, that's not supposed to happen.
I was like, I have a serious problem here. And I looked at it and it was probably the cleanest shear I've ever seen.
Well, at least that's good. You didn't get a ton of metal in the transmission, at least.
Yeah.
No, I was lucky for that. What I didn't realize is that Volkswagen likes to design their axles completely different from everybody else, and they have a bolt running through the very center of it that goes into a nut plate inside of the spider gear.
Mm-hmm.
So then came about disassembling the transmission, pulling out the differential, and disassembling the spider gear, all on the kitchen table, right? Like, this is when it's easy to not have a wife, right, who's going to yell at you for doing that.
Exactly. That's single guy shit for sure.
Oh, yeah. For sure. I would not be able to get away with that now.
No.
No, Mandy would absolutely hate that.
Why does the house smell weird?
Exactly. Sorry, there's transmission fluid all over our dinner plates.
Right.
You know, we're going to have to clean that before we eat, you know. But yeah, so I ended up going through, I pulled that nut plate out. It is not a part that you can buy as a replacement. So my only hope was to heat this thing up with a carbide bit, get it molten hot, and then use an extractor set. And
oh God.
Fortunately, my little heart surgery on the nut plate worked.
Wow.
And all in all, it really just cost me an axle cup. And the whole thing went back together, never had the issue again. It was a really solid car. So.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely, it seems like a freak incident just because I've never really seen
an axle shear
like that before, at least on a Volkswagen, you know?
Never. I've never seen that out of any other car. I was the only person ever seen that I know that's had that experience.
Right.
You know you're special when you create a truly unique failure.
Yeah. Yeah. when you Google something and there's no results, you're like, ah, fuck.
Yep. That, I was like, yeah, this might say something. I might need to work on some things with seat time here because that was pretty painful.
Yeah. So then run us through your car history, because we briefly touched on a couple there, but.
Yeah, so I had started out, I had a 2001 Nissan Maxima, which was definitely not the car I wanted for my first car, right?
Was that an automatic or a manual?
Unfortunately, it was automatic.
Ah, damn, because the manual ones are pretty cool.
They are. I had to buy Uncle Jerry's car.
Yeah.
Right? Like, my dad had put these stipulations. He told us, you know, when we were about 10 years old, all right, your sister has totaled both of her first cars. You're going to have to save for your own now.
Oh no.
So I had hit this point where I was like, well, thanks, Nikki. Like, you really screwed us.
Right.
And she had a V6 Accord and she had a Del Sol.
Okay.
Those were her first two cars that she had totaled in Orlando. And I was like super upset about it because now I've got to save for my own. And I'm like, all right, you know, first world problems and shit. So I like spent my time mowing yards and like doing odd jobs here and there. I once buffed and waxed a 40-foot Prevo. For a guy for $500. Like, that was the kind of desperation I was in, like using a ladder climbing this Prevo and getting after it, you know, hand polishing it.
Man, I remember The only fiberglass work I've ever done was my uncle was restoring an old motorhome that was fiberglass. And I remember that being, I hated that. I can't imagine doing that to, like, I didn't get very far and it took me days.
It was rough. It was definitely rough, but I ended up coming around and I had saved up about like $5,500, which wasn't much. And Dad was like,
It's not bad though.
Yeah. But he was like, you don't really have a choice. Jerry's selling his car. You're buying it. And I was like, shit.
Like, come on. I did all this work. At least give me the choice.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was one of those things where it's like, you know, my family was very patriarchal, right? Jerry was the patriarch of the family type of deal. So if Jerry said it, it went. So of course I bought that, you know, and then I started doing research on it, right? Because I had wanted like a manual 325i to get started with, because I thought, you know, hey, this is a good platform, rear wheel drive,
right?
Good power plant, you know, they're pretty consistent.
Yeah, they handle really well.
They handle really well, but they don't handle wallets really well, or no. They do.
Well, yeah, depending on how you look at it. Yeah. For me, being a technician that works on BMWs, I love them. So.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and if you're familiar with the platform, it's good.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. As long as you plug up those leaks before they happen.
Right. Absolutely. But what ended up happening, I got that. I did the more research I did, I was like, wow, this really does have all the same heart of a 300ZX. Like, I can fool with this just a little bit.
Right.
You know, so of course, high school kid, you know, add an intake, do some shoddy exhaust work, and, you know, call it good. You know, I had that for a couple of years, and then I ended up giving it to somebody when I left for the Army. There was kind of a family that was hard up at the time, and, you know, their daughter needed a car, so I wasn't going to try to transport it with me all over the country for the Army, you know. So
not for a Maxima.
Not for a Maxima, no. So, you know, fast forward about a year, I finish up with all my training. I ended up tracking helicopter mechanic in the Army, working on Apaches and stuff like that, and I get stationed here at Colorado. And I had looked around. There were a handful of cars I remember looking at. There was a manual IS-300. I was, like, really interested in it. The guy sold it out from under me. And then there was, like, a Bug-Eye WRX, which, of course, is, like...
the Colorado car.
Yeah, right. You throw a rock, you're going to hit one out here. And then there was this 2004 Civic Si EP3 with 50,000 miles on it for $9,000.
And this was how many years ago, then?
2014.
Okay, that's a good price.
Yeah, it was not bad at all. So I ended up, it was in Brighton. So I drove over there and I went and picked it up. And I really didn't know how to drive manual that well.
Yeah.
So my buddy dropped me off in Brighton. I pick up this car and then starts, like, you know, I'd driven a couple of cars over the years from some people I knew. My history teacher had a Mazda Speed Miata that he taught me how to drive in.
Oh, nice.
Wow. Those are super rare these days.
Yes.
That's a cool teacher.
Yeah. He was actually a Top Gun pilot.
Oh, was he?
Yes.
Okay.
He was a Top Gun pilot, and he ended up being mine and my brother's American history teacher. He had a Datsun 240Z in the garage, a Mazda Speed Miata, and a red AP2 S2000.
This guy's got great taste.
Yeah, right?
Yes, absolutely. Mr. Kenninger was like, just, he was the shit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he was a cool dude. RIP. Like, he ended up getting like a really nasty tumor. Oof. When Andrew and I were both in high school, and like he passed on a few years later. But yeah, I mean, like, his taste was spot on. He took the time to teach me how to drive manual, and so like I went and picked up this EP3 and drove it back. And I remember I was pulling up to the gate. I was like, ooh, I really don't want to stall this at the gate, right?
Right, yeah.
So what I did is I, like, found this hill right outside of Fort Carson, and I'm sitting there, like, practicing going uphill with the clutch, trying not to look like an idiot when I come through the gate so I don't stall it there.
Right, I can only imagine how much shit you would have got if you would have stalled it at the gate.
Oh, my God. Imagine being the guy that, like, stalls 10 times at the gate and people are waiting on you, and you're just like, I'm new.
Give me a chance.
Forgive me.
Yeah, it's kind of how I learned to drive stick was I bought my Miata, and... I had very briefly, my dad tried to teach me in his old Ford Ranger one time, but my dad, I love my dad, not a great teacher. I almost ran into the side of the house and I was like, nope, I'm done. Well, I just went to get the Miata. I was like, well, I watched some videos. I think I know how this works. Here we go.
Yep. Yep. And that was the other thing. YouTube is a great teacher, right?
Yeah.
Like, you can learn a lot. You can also learn a lot of bad habits.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I was able to weed those out pretty good.
You destroy a few sets of front tires while you're figuring it out?
No. Fortunately, that Honda did not have enough horsepower to do that. So
nice.
I mean, it was, obviously, you know, they come K-Series, but it's the worst K-Series motor that's ever been produced.
It was the introduction of the K-Series in the U.S.
Well, I mean, so it was, and it wasn't right, because we got the Type S as well in 2002. They both came out same year. We had one that had, you know, 200, and it was like 200 horsepower even out of the K20A2. And then we got the EP3 K20A3, right? And I, of course, blew that motor because I was a total asshole back then. I wanted to race everything that was on the highway.
Right.
In true Honda fashion.
Yeah, you know, taking a Honda and going highway racing, it seems like the most logical thing to do.
Right. Absolutely. Yes. Rev it out to 9,000 RPMs, even though you don't have a Type S oil pump and the rod journal ends are significantly smaller.
Yeah, it'll be fine. I mean, clearly not.
These were all the things I learned. I ended up like dropping the car off with a guy and it sat with him for 4 months. And I was like a young kid, paid $1,000 of labor up front. And I come back 4 months later, I'm like, yo, dude, why is there no progress on this? And he's like, it's after hours, get out of my shop. I have a no return policy.
Wow.
And this started my indoctrination into learning how to build engines myself.
You're like, well, yeah, if clearly I can't get this done anywhere else. It's, you know, can't.
Yeah.
Somebody else can't do it. You do it yourself, right?
Right. And so that kind of became my moment where I was like, okay, I am a helicopter mechanic on Apaches. Why am I paying somebody to fix my fucking Honda?
Right.
Like this
it seems like that would be easier.
Right. This makes no sense. Like if I can memorize all of the torques for how to tear apart a main rotor head assembly and put it back together, I should be able to understand a K-series engine.
And there's no FAA inspector when you're putting it back together.
No. I mean, there definitely should have been because there was a lot of zip ties involved.
How many bolts did you have left over?
I mean, how many boxes of bolts did I have left over? There was actually once a time where I had 3 out of 4 engine mounts, and I was like boosted making 380 wheel horsepower.
Oh, Jesus. Wow. Well, and clearly you only need 3 then.
Yeah.
I mean, realistically, right? The back motor mount on the K-series setup that mounts to the trans is like solid enough.
Right.
You know, I was like, all right, I'm not going to rock back and forth too much. Fuck it.
I mean, technically every manufacturer is going to a 3-mount system now. Like my Fiesta has 2 side mounts and a torque mount down below.
Yeah. And that's the same with the Mark 7 GTIs as well. I mean, that front mount was like, sure, I'm sure it's there for a reason, but it wasn't on mine. So, and it never gave me a shot. <Yeah. laughs> So I had gotten that car and the motor was kind of an iffy build. Somebody had like taken on building a K20A3. They didn't, you know, they didn't make rods for it. I think Crower made a set of rods for it once upon a time. But that smaller rod journal, and it was the only crank that came like that. So I ended up swapping everything over to an A2 crank, doing a set of Manly H-beam rods, and I had the aggressive desire to go 12.5 to 1.
Oof.
On E85.
Wow.
I didn't know that the previous owner had milled the head.
Oh.
Right, and so, this is where my education in claying your motor and getting proper clearances comes into play.
Right.
Right, so broke Army private assembles this motor, and I turn it over, and I just start hearing the clack, clack of doom, you know, and I'm like,
just valves and pistons meeting each other.
The most heartbreaking thing ever. And I pull the motor back apart and I see that there is a clean valve stamp into the piston. And I'm just like, oof.
Man, that had to have been really close then.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it was heartbreaking.
And how much time had you had into the motor at this point?
Oh, God, I don't know. It was enough to make me very upset. I mean, I had made so many mistakes with that first build, but you know, I don't really see mistakes as mistakes. I see them as learning experiences, and that's really what it was. And I can tell you, I never assembled a motor that way again.
Yeah.
Right. I've been significantly more moderate with compression ratios, and actually figuring out what clearances are there for, you know, understanding oil wedges, you know, proper combustion chamber stuff, and like actually getting shit right.
Right.
You know, and I'd worked with a couple of guys. I had a pilot that had like 1,000 horsepower Evo that also like kind of helped walk me through all of this stuff. I knew a guy with he had a Viper that, you know, he owned a couple of dealerships up here in Denver as well. So I ended up making some friends in the community that had a lot of knowledge and giving me the walkthrough instead of just slapping motors together in my garage, wishing for the best.
Right. Yeah. Like you said, I mean, the internet's great for some things, and I think it's getting a little better than it was kind of back then, about resources and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, finding somebody that you can teach you, that knows what they're doing and can teach you in person is just, it's always going to be better.
Well, and then, you know, when you're young and you're a kid, you have all these wild aspirations of like, oh, if I just stick this cam in here, like it'll make more horsepower.
Right. Just slap a cam in.
Not unless it's going in tandem with all these other working parts that are designed to correlate with it. You know?
Right.
So, and that was just a big part of the learning curve for me.
Yeah.
It's like understanding that there is a lot of misinformation on the internet as much as there is good information. You know, so.
Ironically, that was also slightly similar to my Miata. I had I took the engine out of it just to give it a refresh, like did a rebuild of it and just check all the bearing clearances and stuff. I just wanted to like learn, you know. And then we got in a hurry putting it back together, and the one heater core hose was the end broke off the heater core going into
the back of the firewall.
Yeah.
Yep.
So that broke, and I was like, ah, fuck, I don't know what to do here, because we were trying to finish it up, and I just ended up capping off the heater core hoses. If you guys are listening on a first gen NA Miata, don't do that, because the coolant flow through that head or through the whole engine requires it to go through that heater core. Otherwise, you only get coolant flow through like the first two cylinders.
Wow, so you can't just delete the heater core on one of those.
I mean, you can, but you have to do like a coolant reroute and stuff.
Yes, Moss Miata sells a coolant reroute for that.
Yeah.
But yeah, actually just pulling the engine out of my NA Miata just about a month ago, my heater core coolant hoses started to bend right there as soon as I was taking them off. And I was like, ooh, no.
Yep. And unfortunately, I ended up cooking the back cylinder, and it was just, it fried the rings. It just got way too hot. And it drove for a while like that, but just getting no coolant flow. And that was, you know, you got to learn those lessons sometimes.
Yep.
But luckily, you know, we found another engine. I threw that engine. Actually, it was out in the thumb of Michigan by where my parents live, which was really weird because, like I said, there's no imports out there.
Right.
But my dad knew some guy that had a Miata engine. I was like, weird. So we threw that in the trunk of my Chevy Lumina and then took that to my buddy's shop and had that. I think we swapped that engine in about 2 hours.
Yep. It is a super easy engine to pull, especially on that first gen, right? Because, and this is something that I learned between the first and second gen, because I had done the motor on my 99 as well. Just actually, if you're out there listening to this, there is an oil leak that is really common at the back of the oil pan. Be wary of it, because you will throw a thrust washer.
Oof.
Yes. So I had the great luck of finding one at Pull and Pay down in Colorado Springs. There was an 01 bottom end down there. So I ended up kind of have like a quasi MSM build as far as like 99 head with, you know, the higher compression ratio of the 01 bottom end. So slap that together, threw it in the car. That car actually made its way around my unit. It was kind of like the unit slut. So I had picked that up from an Air Force guy that I knew that worked in tandem with our unit. From there, I sold it to a buddy of mine, Eric Cawthorn, that had that Mark 7 GTI that he let me drive that I love so much. From then, he gave it to our buddy Jordan Diggs, who was also in the same unit, who then gave it to Will Campbell, who was also in the same unit. And the car came back to me, or it almost did, because somebody pushed Will Campbell into a median and the entire frame got wrecked.
Oh, man.
And he was like, I don't know if you can salvage this, but I wanted to give you the call just in case, because I know you'd put a lot of work into this. And it was really nice that he did that. But I was at a point where I had just picked up the DA Integra and I was full send into that, right? Like, it was really, I had my hands full.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I mean, bent frame in a Miata, you need a new chassis at that point.
Yeah. I mean,
you might be able to straighten it on a frame straightener depending on the work, but I never really trust that shit.
It'll never track right again.
Yeah.
No. So, I mean, and that kind of like, I guess, brings us into the DA, right?
Which we were hoping to have you drive up and, you know, shoot some video for us, but we'll get other chances for that one.
Yeah. And probably will in July. Like I said, it's really just an exhaust leak that I'm running into.
Yeah.
It just popped and it was flooding the cabin right there at the collector. And I was not going to windows down it all the way out here.
Windows down it, possibly, you know, get some carbon monoxide poisoning, pass out, you know.
Yeah, I drove it like that from South Carolina to Alabama. And I can tell you my eyes were redder than they've been on the devil's lettuce. It was a rough time, man. So, as soon as I got the car down to Alabama from South Carolina, where I was keeping it with my brother, that was the first thing I did, get a proper alignment back on it and go ahead and seal up that exhaust leak. And it really wasn't that great of a job getting it sealed up. Yeah. So it is what it is.
Yeah. But anyways, the story behind that DA is actually, it's a pretty cool story, I think.
It's a little bit heartbreaking. It's a little bit cool at the same time, right? So you know, my Uncle Bob, around the same time that I had picked up the EP3 back in 2014, I was out visiting him in Descanso, California. We were talking about, you know, possible builds with the EP3. And he had this SECA Fox Body Mustang that he had been driving for decades, right? Like, that was what he absolutely loved. So he took me out to go drive this Fox Body. As we're going through these, like, canyon runs, mountain passes, whatever you want to call them out in Descanso, California, we are on this back road and I see this black Integra Type R parked in this guy's driveway with a for sale sign on it. And I absolutely slam on the brakes. And of course, I mean, like it's a 5.0, you know, Fox Body, it's loud. And we're sitting outside of this guy's house, like, and I just bebop up into his driveway. Right. Like I was very unfiltered at that time. Like what's yours is mine. I'm here.
I don't feel like you've gained that much of a filter since then.
Never going to, never will. It runs in the family.
Right.
So I ended up walking up into this dude's driveway. He comes out and he's like, yeah, man, it's for sale. $11,000, 75,000 original miles.
Wow.
Completely unmolested, entirely stock.
Can you imagine what that car would go for these days?
About 80 G's.
Yeah, that's true. We did see that at auction. Yeah.
Yeah. A clean Integra Type R, especially a real Integra Type R in the U.S.
Yep.
In you know, left-hand drive. And excruciatingly expensive.
It was gorgeous, and it was completely stock. The paint on it was absolutely flawless. It had been meticulously taken care of. So Uncle Bob picked that car up for $11,000. I didn't know it at the time, but he put my name on the title as well. He had intended to give it to me. And around that time, his neighbor was selling his DA Integra to pay for his mother's cancer treatments. So Uncle Bob threw him a nice check for the car to help him out. Uncle Bob's kind of different, right? He's a little out there, but he's just a good dude. You know, he just does good stuff for people.
Yeah.
And he'd help this guy out and then went into this long project of pulling parts together for this DA Integra. Fast forward a few months, he's got all this stuff. We're going over it. You know, he gets a nice $700 high-tech header made for it. You know, I mean, he gets the engine sent to JDM Concepts and has them do a full build on it, balanced, blueprinted, all that, right? And he goes through, has the head ported and polished, Super Tech dual springs and retainers, Crower cams, the high-tech header, Skunk 2 manifold, 64 millimeter throttle body, and does a full suspension, full brakes, bolt-in cage. And before he gets the chance to assemble it, somebody steals the DC2 Type R. And
the story of so many freaking Hondas, especially out there in California.
Yep. And he actually bought like a security system for it to install on the car, like a good anti-theft.
Just hadn't installed it yet.
Oh, no.
So it was like this really heartbreaking thing for him. And I think he really lost the desire to build the car and finish assembling it after that.
I can't blame him. I mean, that's really disheartening.
Oh, dude, it was like absolutely heartbreaking. And I still, again, had no idea my name was on the title. Right, like that was a defeating thing when I found that out.
Right,
was
yeah, like, you're like, oh, that could have been mine.
Yeah, and that was one of those things. Like, that's a car that if I would have gotten it, would have left completely stock.
Yeah,
right, just driven it for what it is, what it was designed to be. Mm-hmm. Right, may have put a track tire on it and run it at some fucking track attack events.
Yeah, you might as well throw some good tires on it.
But right.
Yeah, I remember like you know back in the day reading car magazines and seeing tuned Type R's and stuff like that, turboed Type R's and shit like that. And now that almost seems sacrilegious to do that.
Right. Yeah. Like if you're going to do that, right, just get an LS motor and just slap some rods in it and turn the boost up.
You know,
yeah. If that's what you're wanting to do, do that. But pulling a B18 C5 just for, you know, that, it just seems wrong.
Right.
Yeah. Numbers matching in a Type R. I mean, even when I see guys building GSRs these days, I'm like, that's kind of, you should probably just leave that kind of unmolested.
Dude, I just saw a beat GSR on CarGurus going for $11,000.
Jesus Christ.
Like, absolutely not. Like, I'm not paying that for a Type S. I'm not paying it for a GSR.
No. There's so many cars. Like, if I, like, we were talking earlier, if we had a time machine, you know, going back, I'd make a list of cars and give it to my younger self and be like, just whatever you have to do, buy these and store them.
Yep. Yeah.
Like, you will make bank. Trust me.
Yeah.
I would have bought a 993 Porsche in high school.
I would have bought an NSX.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah. I remember almost like, I mean, I was a broke, like fresh out of college, and there was an NSX for sale. I don't remember the exact price, but I remember it being cheap enough that I was like, I could do that, you know?
I would have bought Kenninger's MSM Miata.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Just for the history of it, right? To me personally, right?
On a 2-year production run, cut sadly short by the factory burning down.
I know, right? Like there was just that fact. There was also that he took the time to teach me in it, right? Like that was big enough. And if I would have gotten the chance to like finish his 240Z, that would have been even cooler. Like that was a car that my dad had back in the day too. So right. It was like kind of like a family thing at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I just love the fact that he was a fighter pilot and he drove a Mazda Speed Miata, because it's like, that just goes to show you how good those cars were.
And, yeah, and chose to take the time to teach American history in Vero Beach, Florida, and right? Like really specify war history too. He was a pretty cool guy.
Yeah. Well, I can imagine him, yeah, being a war buff. It'd be kind of weird if he wasn't, honestly, you know?
Yeah. He was just an all around good dude.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, there was just that aspect. I think that would be like one of the cars that I would really go back and pick up.
Yeah.
And just actually the cars that he had in particular, S2000, just, he left
an
completely
AP2?
Stock.
Yeah. Yeah.
He left that thing completely stock and just drove it, right? Yeah. The MSM he'd modified a little bit, you know? I mean, it was...
But, honestly, the turbochargers that came on the MSNs were... or they weren't that great.
Now, he ended up throwing a nice Garrett on it. And, you know, it was... He didn't, like, tune it way crazy or anything. He, like, turned it up to 15 pounds of boost, and that was it.
And
know?
It might have had the smallest factory intercooler I've ever seen.
Yeah.
It was very, very tiny up in the front.
Yeah, it was a weird system, because it was Mazda didn't I don't know, like it almost seemed like they kind of half-assed that turbocharger system. You know, there's like, we slapped it on there because, you know, it's the anniversary and we want to do something nice, but it was just like, and also though the Miata engineers don't ever want to put too much power in their car,
right?
You know, they're like, they're like, no, this thing doesn't need to make, this doesn't even need to make 200 horsepower. It needs to make like 190.
Well, and now they're giving it a little bit more too, with like its bump up to 180.
Right.
The Skyactiv G motor is pretty solid. I mean, like it makes pretty good torque numbers too. And the delivery itself, I got to drive one of those, and I was pretty happy with it. I mean, there's a lot of tech now, and there's a lot of nannies involved with a lot of cars today. And I think, you know, that's kind of taken away from the driving feel, but that is a car that at its roots is still what it was designed to be.
Right.
Not overpowered, not too ridiculous in like too many fashions. It's, if anything, they've improved on the driving dynamics with a lot of what they've done, and that's been truly impressive.
Well, I knew the ND Miata was going to be good when they're like, hey, we made it lighter than the NC. Like we didn't gain weight.
Yeah.
Like,
nobody's doing that.
No, so, every car gains weight.
And they did a couple of things that was pretty impressive, right? So they widened the wheelbase on it, and then they ended up putting the engine behind the front axles, technically making it a front mid-engine car,
right?
Which drastically improved the handling. And then they also gave it the 30 additional horsepower bump, right? So when you look at that, it's like, okay, like they're more focused on driving dynamics than anything else. And they're keeping that car true to form.
Every Mazda I've driven, like I drove a, it was just a, oh shit, what was it?
Was it the MPV or the 5? That 5?
Oh, yeah,
Mazda 5, the little van?
Yeah, the Mazda 5. It was a, you know, a van, but it had a manual.
Oh, nice.
Oh, that's
okay.
Cool.
Yeah, the Mazda 5 van with a manual. And I was driving that, and I was like, this thing actually handles pretty nice.
Did it have the shifter coming out of the dash like the EP3?
Yeah, kind of.
That's the only part I have left for my EP3. I'm going to let you know that right now. I took that, the column shifter, like the little shift, yeah.
The weird dash shifter.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I kept that.
Yeah, but there's just something about, like, and that's why I think the Fiesta ST is good, because it's also a Mazda chassis. And I think Ford and Mazda really teamed up, because that feels more Mazda than it does Ford.
I remember actually driving one of those. I almost bought one coming back from my first deployment.
Yeah.
And I ended up choosing the Miata.
Yeah.
Which I didn't want to do what everybody else does when they come back from a deployment. It seems like every other person comes back and they buy like a brand new car and they throw away all the money that they just earned, which we don't get much, right?
Yeah, just drive down to Colorado Springs and you see a bunch of people on the highway with Camaros and Mustangs and Challengers.
Typical Army thing to do. Come, you know, get in the Army, buy a Mustang or a Camaro or a Challenger, and it's most likely going to be a V6, which is just sad. Stop it. Please.
Right.
Just stop.
You can't waste your entire GI Bill on a...
Yeah,
on a V6 muscle car
with 20% interest.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and that's partly why I bought the EP3, right? And I actually kept that the entire time I was active duty. I only ended up getting rid of that because a hailstorm came through.
Of course.
June 12th, 2018.
I remember the exact
day. A
day
that will live in infamy.
Yeah, I took pictures of the hail and everything, and I mean, it was almost the size of baseballs.
Wow.
And it took out every window on the car, and it... destroyed the A pillars. There was no bringing that car back.
No.
Yeah,
for people outside of Colorado, like that are listening to this, not for whatever reason, because of the mountains, in the summertime, we get some crazy hail every now and then. Like just completely car destroying hail.
Yep. And I actually lost two cars that night. I had an Acura RDX that I would daily, and I had the EP3, which was at the time, I'd strayed away from what I wanted to do with it. I think I ruined the car, honestly. Mm. This was, again, education point for me,
right,
that I am more of an all-motor guy than a turbo guy. I did what was called a VTEC killer build with the K20 A3.
Okay.
Right. So I had gone back to the A3 at this point. I had an A2 out of the car that was getting the, you know, full build. But I had done a VTEC killer build up here, and UPP had tuned it. I swapped for a 6-speed with a Quaife limited slip differential, and on their dyno made 212 wheel horsepower. I emphasize on their dyno. People were saying those were pretty heightened numbers. A lot of people dial in a big correction factor up here at altitude for the parasitic altitude loss that we get. So 212 might have been a stretch. I would say roughly 180 is probably what it really felt like. All in all, it's still good for a K20 A3.
Yeah, I mean, that's a solid little thing in a...
It was a great driver's car.
Yeah.
It was a great driver's car. It was really fun. I think I ruined it when I turboed it.
Yeah.
Yes. So that configuration was horrible with boost.
Huh.
Like, would not spool.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was like you could not come out of a corner with boost to save your life. So it was a great straight line car. And then that hailstorm came through and took it 2 months after I did that. And I really wasn't driving it much at that point anyways because of it. So, yeah, it was a lesson learned for me.
Yeah, that's a shame.
Yeah, it was. But... Right, both of those cars getting totaled out. I got a nice hefty check for, you know, two cars, and I came back from that happened a week before my second deployment. But either way, I had driven an APR tuned Mark 7, and for anybody that's down in the Springs, like we used to run Helen Hunt Falls. It's like a nice like semi hill climb kind of a thing, and they had put fresh blacktop on it when I had come back from my first deployment, and it was an absolute monster of a driving spot. And I have some videos of me driving the Mark 7 up it.
Yeah.
Really good time I got with that car. I ran 410, 4 minutes and 10 seconds of just solid hill climb up that thing.
That's a long road then.
It is. It's a very long road, and it's two lane, but there's no dividing line. Mm. So it's very risky to run. You have to you really have to gauge who's coming based off of the headlights that hit the rock wall in front of you.
Yeah.
So definitely better to run it at night.
Yes. So it's typically run at like 1 a.m, which, okay. I mean, law enforcement found out and they put a massive iron bar across it to keep people from coming in.
Of course.
Closes at like 9 o'clock.
Oh, of course. Wow.
So
this is like some American Toge battle shit right here. This is like
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
This is the Mount Akina of Colorado Springs.
It really was. So this actually got introduced to me by a guy named Sam Lawler. And he was building, he built at the time, it was like 560 wheel horsepower WRX. And I got to participate in that. And that was a really fun time. I will never own one because of it.
Yep. yeah. I feel like most people usually build one Subaru. They're like, that was, I'm done with that actually.
I mean, he was absolutely invested. I mean, that was a very sentimental thing for him. He had poured so much of his time and effort into it. It was a great car. I mean, like driver's car wise, he had done a phenomenal job. Great coilovers, great brakes, great horsepower, great response. Like it wasn't a super laggy Subaru.
Oh, okay.
You know, I mean, like the power delivery was on point. So it was like an IAG stage 3 block and everything like already pre-assembled sent to him.
Yeah.
And then he built the heads himself, and hearing a Subaru rap out to 9,000 RPMs was unlike anything else I'd ever heard. I was going to say that was wildly impressive.
Hearing that rumble at that high RPM.
Oh my goodness. That was a beautiful sound.
I don't know if I've really ever heard one rev that high.
Yeah. It's the only one I've ever been inside.
I don't think
of
I've ever heard
that.
One get over 7 Gs.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, running those kind of numbers up here at altitude was pretty nice. It was really fun to be in that car. And then him taking me to Helen Hunt Falls and running up it was unreal.
Well, an all-wheel drive on a hill climb is just incredible because you're not struggling to put that power down. You know, it's a fight even in a rear-wheel drive setup, but especially in a front-wheel drive setup when you go around a really tight hairpin, all of a sudden you've got wheel spin. You have to really watch your throttle inputs, but when you're in a WRX, it doesn't matter. You're just trying not to fly off the side of the mountain.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah,
man, I'm really sad that because you were telling me about this story, like, or Helen Hunt Falls, anyways, a few days ago or a couple weeks ago. I don't know. Time's an illusion.
Time's a construct.
Yes, there you go. And I was just like, fuck, I wish I knew about that when I first moved out here, because I think I would have just caught the tail end of that before they. Close that shit down.
Oh, yeah. And there were two that we used to run because Garden of the Gods had a one-way loop at the top.
Okay.
And they used to not bar that off either. So, I mean, there was a group of guys when I moved here that people called the Gardeners. And they would literally, I mean, they would just sit there and tandem run that together. There was a whole group that would just match each other's speed and go up there and run.
That is such awesome. A tame name for a group of guys that go street racing out in a public right? park at night. Oh, who are those? Those are the gardeners.
Yeah,
it was like such a docile name for a group of guys that were just animals.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was like, I don't think I have what it takes to be with those guys. It'd
be great to have like the member jacket.
Right. Yeah, you know? Like me and my EP3, me and my 180 horsepower trying to get up there and be wild. Like, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think the early days of me moving here, there was a lot less constrictions.
Yeah.
Like on, you know, the driving scene here.
Well, unfortunately, like, I mean, I love Colorado, but, you know, so does everybody else, and everybody keeps moving here, and we just get more and more traffic and more people, and even driving the mountain roads at, like, 1 in the morning is getting more packed and more dangerous.
Yes. Should I put out on the podcast the one driving spot that's still good, or do we keep that internal?
No, we keep that to ourselves.
Okay. We could bleep it, though. I mean, you could tell us, and then I'll just bleep it.
Are you actually going to bleep it this time, though?
I will actually bleep it.
All right, so when I come back out in July and bring the DA, then... We will definitely, I'll take you guys out to the road that leads to my mom's old house.
Okay.
And it is by far one of the best winding roads with some of the best fucking highway like you can be on.
We'll drive right up there when we're headed to the hill climb this year.
Yeah, that area.
I mean, you'd overshoot the hill climb to get to it. But it's absolutely like one of the best driving spots around.
Okay.
And there's nobody ever back there. Watch out for wildlife.
Okay.
That's the scary part. Yeah. Like, I've almost hit some fucking deer.
Dude, mule deer do not care at all about their own safety.
No, they don't.
White-tailed deer, they are evasive, but mule deer will walk right up to you and eat Cheez-Its out of your hand.
Clearly, the white-tailed deer down south are different than the white-tailed deer in Michigan.
Oh, do they not care in Michigan?
No, they look at your headlights and just freeze. Or sometimes they'll run off the road and then run back onto the road right before you get to them.
Like they get confused. Like they're just like, oh, okay, like maybe I should leave this. Hold on. Let me see what these lights are about.
Right.
I guess just generations of being hunted no matter where you are in the South.
I mean, the same with Michigan, though. But actually, hunting season always made it worse because the deer would just be everywhere at that point.
Because they're trying to get away.
Yeah. But yeah, where I'm from, like, you know, there was a deer season where the body shops would be full of collisions.
Wow.
Yeah.
So there's deer season for hunting and deer season for the body shops.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like love bug season down south.
Oh, you know what that's like? Yeah. That shit.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Every 7 years, you cannot get away from those ladybugs.
Shit, look at the front of the Jetta now. I think I hit every single one on the way out here.
Wow. Yeah.
That was rough.
I did. That is one thing. Every time I go back to like my parents' place in Michigan, especially in the summer, of course, I'm driving around. I'm like, oh, my God, I need to like clean my windshield. Like, I'm not used to that out here anymore.
You'll empty your entire washer reservoir tank just on one little jaunt.
And then it always sucks when you... Yeah, every time I stop for gas, I just scrub the windshield down.
Yeah, because it always sucks when you run out when you're driving down the highway. Yes. And then you get that smear across your windshield. Like, cool, I can't see anything.
You get the trickle and you hear your motor struggling. Yeah.
You're like, oh, no.
That or then you get the little light notification on the dash. Like, I don't want to see that. I hate seeing lights pop up on the dash. So even if it's for washer fluid, I'm mad about it. I'm like, ugh.
Yeah.
No. Fancy car. You get a light.
Yeah, I know.
One thing I hate about the BRZ and the lights on the dash is even with the stability control off, if I drift it, it has a flashing exclamation point for when you get sideways.
And it's like it's excited about crazy.
It. Yeah. That's how I have to look at it. Because at first it's like, that's distracting. But now I think it's like drift confetti.
Yeah, yeah, it's applauding you for what you're doing. It's like, okay, this is good job. Good job.
Oh, God. I'm just thinking of lights on the dash. And then I got the Fiesta, of course, no lights on the dash. And then at a certain point, I had the check engine light on, the stability control light on. There was some other light on. I'm like, I made it better.
I have always been curious about the BRZs. How do you like them? Everybody complains about a torque curve that I've like never experienced.
So the torque dip is real. That actually exists, but if you just, it's got a 6-speed gearbox. So if you just anticipate it, you can keep it at high RPMs and avoid that.
Okay.
I love everything about the car except the power. It needs more power, and especially when I get it up to this altitude, you can really feel that.
Sounds like a Miata owner.
Yeah. Oh, and you know what? Speaking of Miata owners, the other day I was getting on the highway with Matt, and he's like, wow, there's like really no power when you're getting on the interstate, so I have to turn off the air conditioning. just like your typical Miata, just so I can get enough power to actually merge. It's a great chassis, and I've got the version with the Brembos, so it stops really well. And when I put track tires on it, I'm in love with it. I just need more power.
Yeah, I actually drove that at one of the Track Attack events, and I was shocked how good that chassis is.
Okay, what suspension are you running on there?
It's bone stock. It's just the limited suspension. The only thing I've done to it are the RT660s.
Phenomenal tire, yeah, by the way.
I've got the 240 to modify and dick around with, but eventually that thing's getting more power.
Yeah. I think just a small turbo, or I'm a big fan of the Edelbrock supercharger kits, just because it is such a clean install.
That's the one that bolts up where the AC compressor is, right?
No, this one's a whole intake manifold.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. I think Jackson Racing makes one where it's a centrifugal that bolts right.
Jackson Racing does the Rotrex. They do it for a lot of the K-Series stuff, too. And it seems to be a really good product. But so is the Edelbrock one root style?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I don't know. I don't know what the power band is on that, so I can't really, you know, say anything about that. But I just feel like even a little bit of boost in that engine would just make it perfect.
Yeah, it just needs some torque.
Yeah.
That's it.
The compression ratio on those is like 13.5 to 1, isn't it?
It's really high. I mean, it makes 210 horsepower out of a 2 liter.
Okay. Which, I mean...
Yeah, it sounds about right.
Backtrack to K-Series, right? Yeah. Like 11, right. K-Series 11 to 1 compression.
K-Series did that first. Yeah.
Yeah, but also K-Series are just... I don't know. They just have a different, you know, DNA in them.
It's honestly... Out of all the engines I've handled at this point, it is the greatest motor I've taken apart because it makes the most sense when you're looking at it.
Yeah.
Right. Like when you're going over it, you're just like, okay, wow, this was really smart the way this was designed. I really have zero complaints about it. The only complaint I have is that we moved away from the Type S oil pump in 2006 and we went back to a balance shaft oil pump, and like really upsetting.
And it changed out the oil pan too, so you can't just swap those pumps.
Yeah, you can.
Can you?
Yeah, I was using a Type S pump on my K20A3.
Oh, maybe I'm thinking of the EP3s. I know that there was one K-Series where you had to change out the oil pan if you're going to change out that pump.
I'm not sure which one it was. It might have been the K24Z3, because I know a lot of configuration had to happen. Like, they have a specific windage tray that they use for the K24Z3 when you're using a Type S oil pump. But I haven't really messed around with this K24Z3 yet. That's kind of the plan. I want to see what I can do with that with the Miata, because I know a lot of guys are like, oh, you can't make all motor power with them because you're not able to configure the head because nobody develops cams for them.
But you can put a K20 head on a K24.
You can. There's a specific configuration that you have to do for the K24Z series, just based off of the way the coolant paths flow for the head and what head gasket you're going to run. So I know some guys were running into that issue. That's kind of like the cheap and easy way to do it, though, right? Like, it's not cheap, but I mean, it's the easy way to do it.
Easy way. I'm still shocked nobody makes a cam for it, because I feel like just a good set of cams would wake that engine up a lot.
Honestly, it was the same thing for the K20A3. Skunk 2 is really the only ones that made a cam for an intake-only VTEC setup. And that's actually what I ran in the K20A3 before I did the VTEC killer build. I had a set of Skunk 2 drop-in, like stage 2 or whatever cams.
Yeah.
And you really didn't get valve float out of that motor because you weren't revving it high enough because it didn't have the bottom end to support it, right? So, I mean, I think I ended up taking that to 8,000 RPMs only. But, I mean, it moved well. It did what it was supposed to do. If I had it to do over again, I would have probably left that motor configuration and just put the 6-speed with the Quaife in it.
Okay.
Because it was just a 5-speed, and, like, you absolutely get robbed in second gear on that.
Yeah.
Second gear was just significantly longer than the rest of them, and you lose out completely. You fall on your face in that shift.
Yeah. I mean, we're, not to change the subject, but we were kind of thinking with, the Project CRX of Aaron's here, like we're going to be using this video should be out by the time, or the video should be out by the time this podcast hits, right?
Yeah, we'll definitely have something. So you'll have a visual to put to this conversation. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so we're not going to be spoiling it. All-wheel drive swap out of a CRV. You know, the gear ratios are kind of, you know, not great in that. And I know a lot of people, you were saying, Aaron, don't like those transmissions.
Yeah, the B20 is just not. It's a long-legged. If you're looking at something compared to like a, you know, a 16A2 tranny, or, you know, something that's coming out of an SI or geared for those high-revving all-motor VTEC cars from the factory, yeah, everybody's like, get rid of that B20 shit fucking transmission. But, you know, we're not going to be revving it to the moon, and it's going to have some boost to it. So,
right.
Even still, if you're not revving it to the moon, you know, I would say still do a shorter final drive. And it's just, I mean, like, that's what I run on the DA, and I don't run past 7,400 RPMs. And I run a 4.76 final drive with an LSD and a Type R flywheel.
Okay.
And that has actually helped a lot.
Yeah, I just don't know what options we'll have for the rear diff on the CRV. You know, because I don't know if anybody makes a ring opinion for that.
Dare I say it? I know that PFI deals in this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, but I thought they were using a lot of Wago van stuff.
I'm not entirely sure. I know that I have a guy I could definitely talk to about it. A buddy of mine, Jake Conwell. Actually, you know, he was on the 1320 Denver street scene or whatever. 840 horsepower EG hatch, B18. You know, just massive turbo.
Yeah.
He ended up going all-wheel drive.
Okay.
I don't know if it's done yet. I haven't seen the car since. This was about 2 years ago, the last time I saw it run. He ran a low 10 at Bandimere and then, you know, sheared an axle, and then that was kind of the end of the day.
Jeez, low 10.
Oh, yeah, in a all-wheel drive EG hatch.
Oh, right? It wasn't all-wheel drive then.
Oh, this, oh. Was, all-wheel
this
drive.
Was still front wheel. That
that's even more impressive.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, Jake's a pretty good driver. He went from Mustangs to Hondas. I like to attribute a lot of that to myself. but he had actually, the first time we met, it was when I had the EP3 and we were at the car wash on Fort Carson. And he was hearing that VTEC killer cam just chop. And he was like, I remember him coming over and being like, bro. He's like, why does your Honda sound like a chopped LS, dog? And I was like, VTEC killer, man. It's kind of sick. Doesn't really make as much power as an LS, but you know, it sounds good.
But it sounds good at idle. So
I tell you what, that was the richest tune I ever had in my life.
Yeah.
Not a 9 AFR, man. I was gross. But like when you get to wide open throttle, I mean, it ran a 13. It was, you know, it was fine.
Yeah.
But man, that thing was smoky going around town.
I just want to say real quick for anybody that's listening to this podcast who is not in the Honda scene, sorry, this podcast isn't for you because we've been talking chassis codes and engine codes left and right.
We're always just heavy on the Honda stuff.
Yeah, we are. But I feel like this one, even I'm like, what? The A3, BZ3? Okay, we're getting a little beyond my knowledge of Hondas now.
And I can describe a lot of that stuff too because I did a lot of research on those platforms, right? Like that was, I had a huge learning curve when I ordered K20 A2 rods for my A3 crank.
And you're like, oh, no.
And I like... Yeah. I remember I called this guy up and I was like, hey man, like there's a lot of space here. And even he didn't know. And he owned like a professional tuning shop in town. And he was like, I didn't know. And I was like, clink, 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 clink.
You're like, that's not going to work.
It's a lot of space, man.
It's going to be one thick bearing.
Yeah. And I was like, we talked about it and a buddy of mine, Vic Sanchez, he had also dealt in these a lot. And I called him up and he was like, I didn't know either. And we ended up just picking up an A2 crank, and that's when I was like, all right, this fits right, no more issues, right? But all in all, I mean, yeah, a lot of Honda codes. We can start dwelling in the Volkswagen and Mazda Miata and Subaru stuff if you want to, because that's
like the thing about being Honda guys is you find the best combinations of heads, blocks, you find what internals work in what motors, what oil pumps work, and that's the big thing. I mean, B-Series guys had to figure out that the B20 with the B16 head was the best drag racing setup.
Right.
It took a while, and you know that knowledge is out there now because a lot of people blew up a lot of engines figuring it out.
Well, and the other thing, so I started looking at too because I got really interested in Honda Challenge Series, right? And some of the stipulations for the different classes of Honda Challenge Series is like, all OEM compression ratios and stuff like that.
Oh,
so
that's interesting. You have to keep an OEM compression ratio.
Yes. So I started challenging myself like, okay, if I run the hybrid series of this class, right? Like what can I do with an all OEM build?
Yeah.
Right. So I started looking. K24 A2 from 2006 to 2008 was the 2.4 liter that came out of the Acura TSX.
Well, it made like 204 horsepower.
Yeah, 205, but they one off. Right. Let me just go ahead and correct
that's
that real quick.
In the Honda world.
I just love how quickly you're like 205. Thank you.
Yeah. Could change your whole life in the Honda world. Let me tell you. But I started looking at that, and the only K24 right now with a higher compression is the Z3 and the Z7, right? So take a piston out of that, same matching bore and stroke, right? You put it into the K24 A2. The reason that 2006 to 2008 was the best out of the K24 motors is because the head configuration was most similar to the A2 and Z1 from the K20. So it had a better CFM flow rate. It had a more aggressive cam profile on it. Now, if we're still staying with OEM cams, you can put a K20 cam on that K24 head. Use the K20 Z1 cam. It's from the ITR, right? The DC5 ITR. It's got a higher lift and duration. That's why the 0506 RSX Type S made 210 as opposed to 200 even.
Oh, that's interesting.
So you run that 11-1 piston that comes out of the K24 Z3 and Z7, and you have yourself a good motor that can probably produce somewhere in the mark of 250, 260 wheel horsepower, which
all
in it,
factory parts.
Yeah, with factory compression ratios.
Right. And then so you run into that. I think you're allowed to run an intake, a header, exhaust after that. Like your bolt-ons are very limited, right? But even with that configuration, you're going to see that power all on stock internals, all at 8,000 RPMs, all within the factory rev limit. You can do this.
Wow.
And that was something I looked at, and the cars have to be 2,500 pounds for this series. So it's like, even still, you're moving.
Yeah.
That kind of weight, that kind of power.
Oh, yeah. Moving. That's a great power weight ratio for a hatchback. That's like
it's perfect.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty solid, right? So, I mean, I don't know. That was something I kind of was like scratching my brain at. Like, I have all this K-Series knowledge. How can I apply this to this series? And
right.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that'd be a great engine. I always love when, like, I think the best engines, the best the tuned cars, whatever it is, are things that are built with restrictions where you have to find, like, okay, what's the best thing that we can do within this? Because, of course, with an unlimited budget, you can just make yourself a billet block and, you know, make 2,000 horsepower or something like that. But it's, yeah, going through the parts catalogs, figuring out what parts swap into what, and just like melding them together is, I don't know, that's what I think, you know, with the religion of speed, that's kind of where we're at. You
yeah,
know,
that's what the grassroots are all about, because you're using what's available and you're not breaking the bank.
Right, yeah. Yeah, we're none of us here are rich.
Right.
No.
Unfortunately.
No, not even a little. I think the one thing that was kind of what steered me away from the Mark 7, actually, is that everything was kind of, it was recipes. There were recipes for success, and there wasn't a lot of deviation outside of that, right?
Right.
So, like, I ran into an issue with...
What's up, Hamza? Just going to join in. We need a fourth mic here.
We do. Our fifth absolutely.
Mic at this point.
Because yeah, now Hamza's upset because I'm dogging the Mark 7, even though we shared, literally the same color Mark 7s and everything down to a T. But... I mean, I kind of drove myself out of that because there wasn't a lot of passion in that build for me because there was no challenge to it, right? The Mark 7s are very, these are the bolt-ons you use. This is the box tune you use. Not a lot of people are getting like dyno tunes and like having, you know, stuff that they're really, really building.
Right.
And the more I looked into trying to build, I was like really let down by the lack of support in the aftermarket background for that. Like, I think Integrated Engineering was the only ones making a built block for those for a while. And if you wanted to build your own, you were limited. So, like, I had crank walked my first motor with that. I used a clutch from a company. Are we allowed to name names without being, like, totally fucking roasted?
We usually name names.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool, yeah. Yeah, BFI Stage 3 kit fucking crank walked my motor. And I called them about it, and they were like, we don't know of this problem. And there was a whole forum dedicated to it by the end of the month. All right,
if,
so.
If we get big enough for it to be an issue, that means we've made it to success.
Right.
Hey, my way of looking at it is, you know, if you make a good product, we'll, you know, talk up your product. And if you make a bad product, we're going to tell people. I'm not going to sugarcoat shit.
Well, right. And that's where, like, I was happy Hamza went like stage one and didn't delve out of that yet. Cause I was like, okay, this is where we're going to need my clutch expertise here. Cause man, I have really been through it with these Mark 7s at this point. But you know, so I did like the traditional, you know, intake, downpipe, exhaust, front mount intercooler,
right,
turbo inlet and the turbo muffler delete. And then, you know, I did a little bit of suspension on it. It's Bilstein B8s and a new speed spring combo, 260, 290 front rear. And then I ran the Falcon RT615s that I ran on at the track with you guys, and a barn find set of Ankies for 250.
Barn find?
Yes, 250. They really didn't fit that well. You kind of had to canter them on there and like just bolt that sucker in and send it with a couple Uggas and a Dugga.
Yeah, that's fine.
Whatever,
yeah.
They stayed on.
Hey, well, you know.
It's like running 3 out of 4 engine mounts, right? I
mean, yeah. Clearly it worked.
Yeah, it worked. So.
No, I get that because the Fiesta ST is kind of the same way. Like,
yeah,
you know, there's certain things you do and certain things you don't do. Like, nobody builds those engines.
I think, as a community, as like a car community as a whole, with how modern technology's gotten, we've kind of lost a builder's edge, right?
No, like, I agree, because like with Iggy, with my Corolla, that's a 4AF, sure, it's not a 4AGE,
right?
But it's still the same block and stuff like that, and there's still people out there that are doing stuff with the 4A motors that I can, you know, find parts that work on this. Or hell, I can take a 7A motor, which is the 1.8 liter, that's a 1.6, and put the 4AGE head on it, so it would make a 7AGE, you know, combo. And like there's shit like that you can do with those old cars, just like a Honda. But a Fiesta ST, you're not, I mean, that's the engine. and then you blow it up and you just go get another engine. Like you don't.
Yeah.
Mountune sells an engine, but like nobody. No, I don't know anybody that actually bought those things.
Right, and that's kind of where I think IE stopped doing their distribution of those engines. Right, and I think they stopped a couple of years ago because I had called them up when I had the crankwalk issue because I was like, okay, what's the solution to this? Right, can we make some sort of a spacer that eliminates this thing from being able to walk over without it rubbing too much? What can we get a clearance for so that we still create an oil wedge in this rotating assembly that's going to avoid this? And there really wasn't a solution out there. And I remember talking to you about this over the phone one time where I was like, if I could get with a machine shop and make a layered bearing of some sort to sit there and, you know, keep this from being an issue, mm-hmm. we might not have the crankwalk motor and we could put a lot of these motors back into distribution. And guys could start building and becoming builders with the Mark 7s. I got rid of my Mark 7 before that ever happened. And I was just like, yeah, fuck it. I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
You know, that's a lot of legwork for not a lot of reward.
Well, you went back to Honda where you get the reward.
Well, I'd already had the Honda and something happened at the track. I think you were there that day. I'm pretty sure you were. We had the same track configuration. I brought both cars in the same day, right? Like I had raced the DA in the morning and then hurried up and ran home and grabbed the Mark 7 to race them. Something really, really humiliating happened, right? I had run the Mark 7 and it was making like 360 wheel horsepower, 420 torque. It was really impressive. And my DA Integra was making 120 horsepower at 9,000 RPMs, right? God awful idle, you know.
Stringing that thing out to make 120.
Oh, yeah, man. Absolutely. I ran 7 seconds faster, same track, same conditions in yeah. the DA Integra. 7 seconds faster on the lap. And I was like,
wow.
Fuck me. Why do I have this, you know, $30,000 car when I just beat it out with my fucking DA that sat under a tree for 6 years in Descanso, California that I slapped together in 2 months, you know?
Yep.
Heavy ass wheel on that thing too.
Dude, that, especially those kind of track configurations, the smaller, tighter track configurations, you just can't be Hondas, man. They're light. They have great suspension geometry.
And I just learned my driving style too with that, right? Yeah. Like I benefit from an all motor setup. I like being able to really modulate pedal feel based off of what I'm feeling in that corner.
Yeah.
Right. And there's no better feeling for me than having all motor power on demand and being able to like have a nice sweeper and gradually apply that power and slingshot yourself out of the corner.
Yeah. You're not timing it with when your turbo spools.
Yeah. It's really annoying.
The power delivery.
I know that says something about me not being as good of a driver as Matt, but you know, I mean, at the end of the day, I'm trying. My whole point was try to catch up with him.
Well, you were getting dang close. Like I was kind of worried, honestly. I was like, these fucking Hondas, man. It's like every single time somebody shows up with a little Honda that's underpowered, I'm making twice their horsepower and I can't keep up. Even though the Fiesta is not exactly a heavy vehicle.
No, I think, what, they're 2,800 pounds?
27 to 28, yeah.
Still, that's phenomenal. Right.
Like, yeah. Oh, for a modern car?
Yeah, like, especially for its age. Yeah.
Yeah, that I actually test drove, like the first time I ever test drove one, I took it up Helen Hunt Falls, and the guy in my passenger seat, like the little dealer guy was like, oh man, you really can drive these. And I was like, I've driven this road a lot.
Yeah.
But, and that was the thing I really loved about it, the power to weight. It felt like if Miatas were front wheel drive, that's how they would be.
And that's high praise.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. That's how I felt about the car. And I really kicked myself for not buying one back then.
Yeah.
Because it was a really nice ST3 and it was like, you know, it was the charcoal gray. And
ooh, yeah.
I was really holding on to my sentimental value with the EP3, which realistically on a private's budget.
It's just a shame that the hail had to destroy that, though. That's really sad.
Yeah, so many good cars have gone that way around here.
Look, that car was so far gone. I mean, there were a couple of things that happened. The week I came back from my first deployment, somebody hit and ran me in the rear quarter panel.
Oh, man.
It was already ugly. Like, it was trapped out, clapped out. I mean, it was rough. And then, like, a day later, somebody hit the front end of it. They hit the front right fender. And I mean, like, I could not catch a break.
Dude, that's horrible, man.
And then, like, shout out to my mom. Sorry for this, but, you know, she had left the car sitting outside the entire deployment, and it got hailed on. It was very minor, but it was enough to be absolutely heartbreaking, because when I left that car, when I went to Afghanistan, it only had 64,000 miles on it. And I came back, and it was,
just destroyed.
Yeah, the window seals were, like, dry rotting and stuff. It, like, hadn't been washed the whole time. It was just, you know, it had a rough time, you know. Yep. And, I mean, no offense, you know, she didn't know, like,
proper, ill intentions, and
right, like, yeah, she wasn't being malicious or anything. It's just She had a lot of stuff going on.
You can never expect someone to take as good of care of your car as you would take of it.
No, and again, I was on a private's budget.
Yeah.
There were some issues with my Army career. I was a private a lot longer than I should have been.
Oh, man. Well, I think that's going to have to be a story for another day, because we've been chatting for a while, and I think we could chat for another like 7 hours, but I think we're going to have to call it there.
Yeah.
Because we didn't really get to the whole story, I feel, of the DA, but... when you bring that up, we'll get it on film and we'll finish the story then.
Cause we'll do a build bio.
Yeah, exactly. Cause yeah.
Absolutely. Cause I mean, there's more on in the works with it now.
Yeah.
Yeah,
the whole family affair.
Yeah. My brother doesn't feel the same about turbos that I do. So
yeah,
just a little cue into what's going on with
now. I'll be curious to see what it's like when it comes up here in July.
I'm not turboing it and driving it up here. It's not happening.
Fair enough.
I will turbo it after.
I say, this isn't an episode of Hilo.
No.
All right.
Thanks for having me, guys. This has been great. Seriously.
Yeah. Thanks for coming, man. This has
absolutely
been a great one. You know, I thought I knew a lot about Hondas, but 204, 205, I mean.
the more you
your
know.
Knowledge isn't that good.
Apparently, yeah. Apparently, I need to hit the books.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, MID is some good. We got a case swap the BRZ. That's next.
Yeah. That's how we solve the power problem.
That'll fix it. We can case swap the 240 and dial that in.
Yeah.
Yep.
K-Swap the world.
Yeah.
That's right. K-Swap is life.
All right, everybody. If you want to follow more of what we're doing here at Religious Speed, you can follow us at on Facebook and Instagram at religionofspeed.co, religionofspeed.com, of course. You can keep up with everything. YouTube channel is getting more stuff. We have our nice little preview video of what we're going to be doing here.
I've been watching that all week.
It's so good, Aaron. Yeah. You did such a great job with that. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
I wasn't sure if I wanted a response out of that. Anyways, I think that's pretty much everything. Chris, if you want to lead us out.
We'd like to thank the band Wheels for the use of our theme song, Colors. You can find it on the album Traveler Part 1, and they are at wheelstheband@bandcamp.com.
All right, that's going to do it for us, Heretics. Until next time, peace out.